Hello and welcome to this episode of the Anna Asks podcast. Today I'm speaking with Meg and Bella from She's Sober Sydney, and I'm so pleased to be having this chat. Alcohol and motherhood is a really interesting kind of mix-up conversation, and I'm keen to see where this goes. So before we begin, I would like to recognise that I am here on the lands of the Awabakal people, and Meg and Isabella are on Gadigal country, and we really want to pay our respects to country and to elders and to the longest ongoing culture in the world here in the land now known of Australia. Welcome, Meg. Welcome, Bella.
Thank you, Anna. Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much, Anna.
When I came across your work, I was very excited because this is a topic that really, although it's kind of everywhere, it's also on the margins of the motherhood conversation. So as an introduction to this topic, I was wondering if you could both just give a little introduction to yourself very briefly, and then I've got a whole lot of juicy questions that I want to ask you too.
I'm Meg. I'm a mother of three children, and suddenly they grew up. So I have a 24-year-old, 17-year-old, and a 14-year-old. And I have been a non-alcohol drinker for a year and a month now. And before that, I had tried about 4 years ago. Originally, I didn't actually have my first drink until I was 18, so quite unusual. But I was actually addicted to Young Talent Time. So that took out my addiction. I was obsessed. So it wasn't until I was 18 that I found alcohol. But at 17, I developed a social phobia. So I got up to speak in front of my class at school. I started shaking. I'd always liked speaking in front of the class, and that day it just went downhill, and I couldn't eat or drink in front of people after that. I couldn't speak in front of people because I'd shake. And then generalized anxiety disorder happened on top of that, low self-esteem, you name it. So at 18, when I was offered my first drink and I had straight bourbon, I realized I could do everything I had been avoiding. I could socialize, I could, you know, not shake and find a confidence I'd lost. So I became a binge drinker very early on. I don't think I had an off switch from day one. I was pregnant with my first child at 24, and it was very easy for me to stop drinking because at that time I was like a party drinker. So it was just when I went out, I mean, from 18 to 20, that was three nights a week. In my area, we had nightclubs that had dollar drinks, you know, you name it. So it was very easy to drink quite often at that age. But when I got pregnant, it was also very easy to not drink. I didn't miss it. And I breastfed until my daughter was about 18 months. And then I think I drank once before that and expressed. And then after she was born, I only drank when I went out with friends. And I didn't have my next daughter until 7 years later. And again, I had no problem stopping. Fed her for less time and was back drinking at 6 months, but again, only socially. And then my son, same thing. So social drinking turned into at least once a week. And during this whole thing, my social phobia came back and in different ways. And I still managed. Most people don't know I had that social phobia, so I covered it up. And then, you know, me, all my three kids, I had different mothers groups. And I think the first, when I was young, it revolved around drinking, but the next two, definitely we spent more time drinking, and as in nights out, birthday parties, things like that. And then just, I guess, as they got a bit older, started school, I started work, that just the stress, I guess, came a bit, the load was a bit heavier, and I would, not every night by any means, but I'd have a drink to unwind. And then it was only the last probably 4 or 5 years that I found myself drinking every night. And part of that was due to not only having kids and a job and everything, but a marriage breakdown, you know, just to me, it was just a way to numb from the world and give myself that break. I got to a point 4.5 years ago where I thought, no, this is not working. And I gave up drinking for about 4.5 months. And then I just, COVID happened and I fell back into a pattern, probably because it was more acceptable. You know, I was working from home. It wasn't unheard of to be drinking, you know, when you were at home all the time. So it just became easier to do that and more of a habit again. And it was a year, it was September of 2021 when I just said, no, this is not, I can't do this. I can't work. I can't parent. I can't look after myself and my kids if I'm drinking, and I need to stop. So that's where my journey up until now began. And as we'll discuss a bit later, it's changed a lot of things with my kids and our relationships. And yeah, definitely 100% in a better place now. There's obviously ups and downs and still dealing with all the same stuff, but with a clear head and a bit more patience and just generally better overall for myself and my family. So that's me.
Thank you, Meg. Thank you so much for that introduction. And Bella, I'll get to your turn in a moment. But Meg, as you're speaking there, does it feel like for you that, like, were you aware that your alcohol use was starting to escalate, or was it really like just such a slow creep that it was not something that was on your radar?
I always knew I was a binge drinker, so I knew that from the beginning. But I said this in my introduction podcast about something I specifically remember, and it was when my son was one and our mother's group had planned for our first night out. And one of the mums said, oh, we need to practice. We need to start practicing, you know, getting our tolerance back up. And then another mother who worked with drugs and alcohol said, be careful because that will grow. And the woman who said it was joking, but in my mind, I kind of knew for me, could be a risk, but I still didn't really believe it. So since then I can see that it did grow. And I think at the time, I probably was aware, but I was ignoring it because I knew that at that particular time I could have 2 glasses of wine at night and feel a bit tipsy and go, I'm good with that, put the bottle away. And I got to, at the end, 2 bottles and I could have had more. So over that 10 or a bit less than maybe 8 years, it definitely crept up. And I don't mean it just slowly went over, you know, 2 glasses to 2 bottles over 8 years. It probably was more like 4 years. And then I kept it going at that high rate, which is quite horrendous for people to hear, but it was very easy because my tolerance was building. I needed more to get the same effect. And because of my anxiety, alcohol was making it so much worse. I needed to cover that by drinking. So yeah, it was in the back of my mind. I knew it.
So interesting that anxiety is one of the reasons that you became,
yeah,
that you increased your drinking, and then you had to increase your drinking because it was worsening the anxiety.
Absolutely. Yes.
Bella, your turn next. Tell us your story in a nutshell.
I'm presently a counselor and a coach, and I help men and women to drink less alcohol. And I'm also, together with Meg, a co-host of She Sober Sydney, a podcast all about individual struggles and triumphs over alcohol. And I got to this point probably after having a 20 to 30 year drinking career, I guess. Oh, I should add, I'm a mum of 2 teenage boys, so 13 and 14, and a stepmom to 2 lovely women who are now, 23, 26. But for me, drinking was just very much the answer to giving me courage to socialize, to fit in, to find my voice and my opinions. And that really started quite young, and I drank for those reasons. So I formed beliefs around needing to have alcohol in my life for those reasons. I then went to law school, and drinking was very much something that we did in between exams and at the uni bar. A 20-year career as a lawyer, and I then jumped out of my career when they were quite young, because one of my eldest son had separation anxiety, so he really needed me at home, and I quite happily stopped. And we'll certainly get into it a bit more, but yes, I leapt into mummy wine culture with open arms. And from there, my alcohol use really took a turn and escalated. And it got quite destructive in the final year, so much so that I did have to check out and go into rehab for 4 weeks. And at that point, I then studied to become a counsellor and turned my life around, and everything has really got better from there.
How do you think the expectations of motherhood, particularly working motherhood, and the wine culture kind of contributed to your story, Bella?
Such a good question. And I really believe it's a confluence of many things. So I don't think I'm alone in saying that as a mum, I think I was really ripe for the picking to throw myself into mummy wine culture. And I need to be careful here, because I think we tend to blame the mum or ourselves rather than the substance, because I wasn't looking for alcohol. I was looking for connection and fun and escape. But I think it was the combination of internal and external things. So internally, I'd started drinking at a young age, and as I said, I did it to fit in and connect. So the die had been cast. And then with the stresses of motherhood, I felt vulnerable and alone. And I had come straight from work as a lawyer into motherhood, so I had missed out on meeting mums, you know, at the school gate and connecting. I'd missed all of that. So I suddenly found myself in a position where I could, and I was so looking forward to it. And I had this group of amazing women, similar situations, and alcohol was there to help us socialize and forget the stresses. But then externally, the, you know, the wave of pink advertising was well and truly underway. The memes were there, and all of that was just giving us reassurance that it was normal to drink in the way that we were, gave us a green light or a pink light to drink hard. And I was seeing skinny drinks, pink packaging, rosé for mums, and it was just promising self-care and a solution to all of the tiredness. And I think all of this resonated with me as a mum, and, you know, I was trying to keep it all together. So even if I had alarm bells going off, all of this messaging was reassuring me to keep going. So even if I had my husband occasionally say, you got to slow down, I was kind of being reassured that it was okay to do this. I'm a mum and I deserve it. And I guess, look, also as a teen in the 90s, I also had all of that messaging from TVs that you popped a baby out, you went back to work early, you worked hard, you party hard, then you climbed the corporate ranks and you drank Cosmos. And that kind of then slipped into the way that I socialized with my friends. And we wanted to forget, we wanted to be teenagers. And, you know, I just think I'm not alone in all of this, because alcohol use disorders is growing amongst women. And I think it is fueled by the advertising that really underpins this mummy wine culture.
I think we sometimes have a different conception of what mummy wine culture is. So, like, for me, I would see kind of the memes that you referred to. I've seen shirts in maternity and nursing kind of boutiques that say mum needs wine on them and things like that, and go, okay, well, to me, the mummy wine culture is the escapism at the end of the day, kind of everybody drinking in their own home by themselves to take the edge off the noise of motherhood, because it is noisy and it is stressful and it is isolating. And the version of mummy wine culture that you're talking about can also include sort of socializing that's based around the alcohol use. Is that correct? We're not trying to say, you know, if you see your girlfriend every 2 weeks and you have a couple of glasses of wine together with dinner, that that's mummy wine culture and it's, you know, it's the worst. It's this other full undercurrent of alcohol in everyday life in increasing amounts is normal. Does that seem accurate to you, Bella?
That seems entirely accurate. Yeah. So for me, it was a real invitation to drink a lot with other mums while unwinding and talking about our kids and sharing stories about our kids, popping the rosé and just using that gap at lunchtime before pickup time came around to have a long lunch, and it was okay to do it. And it was reinforced with all of that messaging.
Yeah. So that's really interesting for me to hear too, because I don't have kids who are of school age yet. So the idea of doing this in the day is a completely different conception of what I had thought of it.
Yeah.
Were there some signs for you that something wasn't right with your alcohol use or that you glossed over?
Not in a conscious way. I always thought I'd be fine. I was chasing that deep connection with my friends, and I was also hanging around with people that was drinking quite largely and a lot as well. So, and there was a great deal of confirmation bias on my part as well. I was seeing what I wanted to see. So I thought I was fine, that I was letting loose, that I deserved to. And I didn't see the problem until it really was suddenly staring at me in the face. So it's clear to me now from what I've learned about alcohol that the warning signs were there. But I was, I think you described it at some point in that question, was it like a frog in a pot slowly boiling? I think I was more like, I felt like a bull in a china shop, loud and drinking, and no one knew what to do. And they just thought I would eventually wear out, which I did. So no, the signs for me really happened within the last 12 months, where it escalated to a point where it was obvious that there was a problem, but it was a slow burn up until that point, and then it was quick.
I just quickly wanted to add on that last point, just that, like you were saying, Anna, that you're not at the place yet where you do things in the day, and that I think we can find evidence wherever we're at. So I can see that early on I would get together with friends. Later on, the evidence I found was, either me telling myself or society saying, well, of course you can have a drink at night by yourself. You know, the evidence was there that I wasn't alone, but I was alone. You know what I mean? Like, I never felt that I was doing something other people weren't. So if we're looking to enable ourselves, it's there. It's there. And I was just going to say the other things I did notice in the last cut, and again, it wasn't all through, it was just the last couple of years, was that if I went out, I stopped at the bottle shop on the way home, after I'd been drinking. I wouldn't go somewhere if I didn't think I could drink at my pace without people noticing. I think the last dinner I went with friends, someone said, you just had a bottle. And I thought, nah, that's too risky. So then I would not go. And I also noticed I was covering up some minor health issues. So these are just little alarm bells that started to ring towards the end.
How did each of you maintain your functioning as a mother during this period of both slow burn and escalation?
There is a label, functioning alcoholic, that I don't resonate with the term alcoholic. It's not a medical word. It is alcohol use disorder. But I was definitely high functioning. I felt like crap now that I look back. It becomes normal to feel hungover every day. And it just became, I'd even have conversations with other mums that were drinking a lot of like, I don't even get hungover anymore. Yeah, it's because we're just always in this cycle of feeling sick. And so you just readjusted to living life on that level, a bit low, a lower level of, I'm going to feel like crap, but I keep going. I think I was still there for my kids. I still stand by, I was a good mum. I was always made sure their safety came first. I've always provided for them in every way, shape, or form. But looking back, I know I wasn't present from about 5 p.m. every day. I just wanted them to be quiet so I could drink. But saying that, if they needed me, you know, I was still there, but as it got towards the end, I wasn't there in a very clear way. And they noticed that. And that was a big reason to stop. But as far as going, I went to work every day, I cooked dinner, I shopped, I took care of all my kids' school needs, their emotional needs, as far as if one of them had a therapist at a time, you know, I felt I was doing a really good job. Looking back, I know it was not 100%, obviously, but no matter what, somewhere inside me, they came first still. I don't even know now how I did it. It's really hard to function when you're that emotionally, physically, spiritually exhausted. But as mums, we do that. And somehow I did it even while drinking. And I thought I was trying to help myself. It's really quite sad to think back. But I think with a lot of women, we do function. And from the outside, people would be very surprised to know there's an issue.
I mean, that's the case with many different issues, alcohol use disorder being one of them. Bella, how about you?
Well, I think I crashed and burned and transformed my relationship with alcohol just in the nick of time. So my kids were about 10 or 11 when I really was drinking to the point where I needed to take time out and stop. So I was hiding a lot of the alcohol that I was having. You know, I would in the evenings have a glass of wine, but I'd have it sort of hidden. So in a way, I was hiding it from them. And the conversations towards the end that I was having with my husband, when he was just saying, look, babes, you've got to do something now, it's becoming a real issue, occurred while they were asleep. So they were unaware of those very crucial conversations and behaviors that were happening. But what I do now know is, and a lot of the international surveys show, that our kids as young as 4 do pick up on the imagery and the changes in our behaviors, and they're aware of alcohol at that age. So I think they always would have seen a bottle of champagne when I had friends over. They would have been aware that I changed my mood, that I might have got louder and more argumentative. So I wasn't able to hide everything from them. And they weren't getting the best of me. I wasn't fully present. You know, I was probably fatigued, more anxious. And so I certainly wasn't at the point where I think there are obvious behaviors that they would have seen and can remember. But I think had I still gone down the path and hadn't changed the trajectory that I was on, things would have been much worse. Yeah.
Bella, I think a lot of mothers who are wanting to seek help in any kind of capacity for any sort of substance, a great fear would be how can I actually take time out of my life to go somewhere like rehab? Yeah. How am I going to make sure my kids are okay? How am I going to repair with them that blip in the relationship when I do come home?
Ooh.
What was that whole time and repair phase like for you? Or is it an ongoing work in progress?
No, it's repaired. At the point that I was away, it was terrifying. And I spent a large part of my presence in rehab worrying about my kids, what they would think of me, and how I had, you know, transferred responsibilities of parenting to my husband and my mum, who had to come down and look after the kids for 4 weeks. So all of that, though, has faded in time. The kids were perfectly happy, perfectly fine. And they weren't told that I had gone to rehab. They were told that I had gone away for 4 weeks. On the flip side, I had 4 weeks that many people don't get. I had 4 weeks of self-care. learning about what I was doing and why I drank the way I was. And I had time out from all, I was removed from the stresses of parenting. I mean, how lucky was I to be able to have the opportunity to be able to do that? And when I was there, I then started my studies. I enrolled in my studies to become a counsellor, and I started the process of then thinking about how I was going to talk to my kids about alcohol. I have come back and I've spoken to them about it now. I've been very open about my drinking habits and my struggles with alcohol. And I've done this really consciously because I think our kids, well, I think I owed it to them to let them know the reasons why I don't drink anymore. And I also think talking about them has a whole lot of benefits as well. And, you know, to that extent, I've created a course about kids and alcohol, how to talk to your kids about alcohol. And it's largely because I needed to be able to feel like I was communicating my story to them and hopefully helping them not fall into the traps that I did.
Yeah, that's a big topic in itself. Obviously, you have some podcast episodes on exactly that on the She's Sober Sydney podcast, talking with kids about alcohol, and your course as well. Perhaps, like, if there's one most important message.
Oh, yes.
What would it be? What should our starting point be if we want to be able to start talking about this? Because kids do see it, you know. We don't have too much TV time in our house, but when we watch the football and the cricket, we're inundated with alcohol messages. So what would a key thing be to start the conversation?
Oh, I love this question. I think, gosh, I could give three and I'll do it really quickly. It might just be, where you say, hey, have you noticed that there's advertising that pops up about alcohol on TV, or have you noticed adults drinking in the shows? What do you think about that? And just start the question. And it's becoming alcohol aware, because you can actually then just start saying, look, why do you think they're showing alcohol and representing it in this way? Why are they showing it to be fun, to promise friendship? Don't you think that's weird? And you can kind of then just start creating a critical awareness in their own minds around, well, why are they showing alcohol in that way? Well, they want to make money. And so they can try and, you know, the penny drops quite quickly that they're being, you know, manipulated into wanting to spend money and drink. The second point would be to, I think, explain a disconnect between our messaging around alcohol to them and our own drinking behaviours at home. No matter where you sit on the drinking spectrum, if you're just having a bottle of wine on a Friday night with your partner, I think it's actually really good to say, look, you might have noticed that mum and dad have a bottle of wine. What do you think about that? Have you noticed that we drink to relax, or why do you think we do it? And then just really succinctly and factually just say, yeah, look, we do it because of X, Y, Z. Put your own reasons in. I like to try and, you know, keep it under control, but adults drink for a variety of reasons, and just explain your story in a way that is true to you, because by doing that, you've opened up the conversation, you're sharing stories about alcohol, you're taking away the allure of it and the power of it as being some magical adult's drink. And by doing this, I think you've opened the door then for them to come to you and start sharing their thoughts around alcohol in their own social lives and when they start seeing it at parties and beyond.
Yeah, so we're looking more to open up the conversation rather than give them a taste for it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, most certainly on that front, the studies are quite clear. There's no precautionary benefits gained from allowing a sip of alcohol safely, in inverted commas, in our own households. You know, that European modelling that a lot of parents sometimes refer to really doesn't work in Australian culture. It Yeah, and I could go on about that, but
Yeah, that idea that if they're allowed to drink at home, then it'll be in a safe, controlled environment in the home. They won't take it outside the home and drink in risky ways really doesn't ring true in our society at
that's
all,
right.
unfortunately.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for that, Bella. Meg, how has your experience of motherhood changed since saying goodbye to alcohol?
Oh, gosh, in a lot of ways, really. I just wanted to say a little story that because I spoke to my 17-year-old last night because I was coming onto your podcast and I wanted to ask her what her experience has been since I stopped drinking. And along the lines of opening conversation with your kids, you know, it means I can ask that. At the first time, like the birds and the bees talk, it's uncomfortable. But like I was telling my daughter, well, I just noticed with her recently how much fun has with her friends. And I said, you know, and she's 17 and they're not interested in alcohol. And I said, you get such a natural high from hanging out with your friends. I said, and what happens when you introduce alcohol? It's not natural. And, you know, hold on to that natural enjoyment of life. So we have conversations like that. But she said to me, it's more awkward for her, I think, she was like, what? Because I was like, am I a better mum since stopping? And she goes, what? She goes, well, obviously I don't hate you anymore. And I said, oh, I said, you know, I didn't do it to upset you. She goes, I know, but it just happened that that's how I felt. And very confronting. And my eldest and my youngest, nothing like my middle daughter. She was furious when I was drinking. So up until she was about 11, she wasn't, I don't know. I was very good at drinking only when I was out. So my kids actually didn't see me drinking until, you know, the last 4 years at home, really. We didn't keep alcohol in the house. And that was specifically because I didn't want them to see me drunk. I wake up hungover, but they didn't know where I'd been the night before. So when she got a bit older and I did start, you know, having wine by myself, she started texting me from her bedroom in capitals. I hate you. You're ruining my life. That went on for a good 6 months to a year. She was probably 14, 15. And so it was very difficult for me because I couldn't just stop, you know, at that point. And I knew that I was hurting her a lot. She didn't feel secure. And so a massive part of me stopping was because I knew that I was not providing a secure home for her. I was, like I said, always my kids came first, but her experience wasn't of that. And she was scared. I believe that she was very scared she'd lose me, that I'd do something stupid, or she knew I was drinking a poisonous substance. She was worried about me. And that came out as anger and fear. So to hear her say, you know, I don't hate you. She said, of course you're different. She goes, everything's different. And she's just calmer, secure, happy to be at home. I'm teaching her to drive, which is unheard of for any of my family and friends would be like, yeah, what? Because, you know, I was so anxious. But funnily enough, the anxiety's gone with, well, not fully, but with stopping drinking. So we have a lot of time together now in driving lessons, which is a time for her to talk to me. And she's opened up about a lot of very personal things, which is huge. My son, who's very, very quiet, I just make a point of going in and hugging him and saying the tricky stuff. So that's improved. I feel that he's happier and calmer. And then my eldest daughter, who was always very understanding of why I was drinking, she knew, you know, the reasons. I think, you know, I think she's proud. And for all my kids, I think they've just learned so much. So my two daughters are not really interested in alcohol, I think possibly from what they've seen, but they're also educated and very aware. And like I said, they're quite happy naturally, which is fabulous. But I think all three of my kids are just much more relaxed and feel safe and secure. And I know, going back, that my anxiety disorder was just because little me didn't feel safe and secure, not for the same reasons, but just I know how vulnerable we are as kids and how much it'll shape your life. So I had to you know, I really, really wanted to change that for my kids so that they knew that mum and home is their safe place always, and it always will be. So that's, I think, in a nutshell, how it's changed our relationship. So 100% better than it was.
I can't think of a more meaningful and important motivation than that, because we can talk, you know, we can talk all about the things that we do for our own health and but you can't put much higher than the security and safety of your kids and making sure that they feel really loved. Yep. Thank you. And good on your daughter for being able to say those things too.
Just, yeah.
Yeah. That she can say that to you shows how safe she feels in your presence.
Yeah. Thank you.
Bella, how about you? Your experience of motherhood since going alcohol free?
I think since I've become alcohol free, I am just so much happier. And, you know, I think when you drink, it's a form of abandonment of self. So what my kids now get is me wholly and solely present. It's far from perfect, but I'm here, accessible, and I'm less reactive to sweat over the small things, I think, because I'm less fatigued. And, you know, I used to really stress and get anxious when there were little things that my kids would bring to me, you know, just little things at school or the fact that they didn't like to go to camp. My eldest son hates going to camp. I would ruminate and stress over it. And I think a larger part of that is just all of those, you're tired and more exhausted. All those problems are compounded when you've got a hangover. So I'm just less anxious and I'm present. I'm more energetic. And I think just the fact that I've found my purpose a bit more now than what I used to have has to rub off on them. They're seeing a happier, more energetic mother that enjoys herself. And it always amazes me just taking that one thing away, alcohol just profoundly improves so many facets of your life and motherhood. Yeah, it's for me the most important one.
Bella, you've mentioned exhaustion and tiredness as something that you experienced while you were drinking. And I think those of us who are mothers without drinking or drinking at very low levels still experience that a lot. I think it was in your story, you were talking about how you were using alcohol as a way to help you wind down and relax and go to sleep without understanding the effects that it then had on the quality and quantity of your sleep itself. Would you mind just touching on that for a moment, please?
Vicious cycle, to be honest, because you're drinking to relax, and for me it was self-soothing, quite an activated nervous system. So I was always quite, you know, ticking things off the list, being busy, quite worked up, and I didn't know that I was quite activated. So drinking wine relaxed me, was that immediate sense of relief, and that formed the belief that I needed alcohol to relax. And it's funny because at the same time, it also, I thought, gave me a bit of energy to be able to deal with cooking dinner and focusing on all the bath time and all the rest of it that motherhood entails. Then it helped me go to sleep. And what we now know is that when you have 20 minutes of relief from the dopamine effect, it's that alcohol is both a depressant and then a stimulant. So you get that 20 minutes of relax, then your body is like wanting to reach and maintain homeostasis because there's an imbalance, and it kicks in adrenaline and cortisol, and it's pumping stress hormones into your body. And those hormones stay in so much longer than the dopamine, and that kicks in when you're asleep, and it disrupts your sleep. So you're not having all of the proper juicy REM bits that you need during the night, and you're waking up exhausted, fatigued, not necessarily realizing that was the alcohol before that's caused it. And that is then setting you up for desiring alcohol again to get through and relax and find energy and get through again. So it's a compounding cycle.
Because it's so easy when we have particularly little kids who need you through the night, that you have this experience with alcohol where you feel helping you relax, appearing to help you get through that really intense period of the evening. Yeah. And then when you're woken up in the night, it seems to be because of the children. And when you're tired in the morning, you go, oh, my kids have had a really rubbish night again, blah, blah, blah. But you might not actually ever join the dots that alcohol has a piece in how tired you are as well, when particularly when you're only drinking at low levels. But even low levels are having this, hormonal shift up, down, up, down, hooking you in a way.
Yeah, it just takes even one or two glasses that can disrupt your sleep patterns. Mm. And you don't connect the dots. That's right.
Yeah. Amazing. How do each of you sort of define gray area drinking? It's a term that I hadn't heard of before coming across your podcast and reading Jill Stark's Higher Sobriety book, because I'm sure many people listening, some may have an alcohol use disorder, some may not be in that camp at all. Where is this gray area that you're talking about, and how do you work with people in that middle zone?
There's a wonderful definition by the wonderful Jolene Park, who coined the gray area drinking phrase, and it's that very large space between every now drinking, every now and again, say a few drinks once a month, and rock bottom where you're physically addicted. So it's a large space and you can fit on the spectrum. And no matter where you are on that spectrum, you can still have a voice that's saying, I need to stop, because if I keep going, it's going to become a problem. Or just these bits, the way that I'm drinking is making me, it's not serving me, so I need to stop. She's created 10 characteristics of a grey area drinker, but probably just the most useful ones would be grey area drinkers. They drink frequently, not necessarily most days, and they can go huge periods without drinking, but they often binge drink. You drink to drunkenness, so you want to keep having more once you start, and you feel the physical effects of drinking, the headaches, the night sweats, sleep, vomiting occasionally, but not all the time. But you also feel the emotional effects of drinking. So you can feel that anxiety, the irritability. You can also stay stopped for long periods of time. You could do Feb fast or Dry July, but it's hard to stay stopped. So that would be the main characteristics there of grey area drinking. And many of us in Australia fall into that category.
Yeah, I would say that that sounds like 90% of people that I know, really, of adults. Yeah, it's just the cultural norm in Australia.
It is.
And really, when I think about it, I know very few other people who have chosen to be completely alcohol-free unless there is a religious reason or unless they have experienced an alcohol use disorder. It's quite an unusual thing to have. Most people are in that gray area, middle ground. Then is your work with people who are in that gray area of drinking just when people want to stay stopped but are having difficulty or want to moderate their intake? Where do each of you work somewhere in that zone?
Yeah, look, my clients are anywhere on the spectrum. So it's really, if you want to stop or have a break, my coaching will help with that, as will Bella's. Now, a lot of people, and I did at first, will want moderation to start with because, forever's scary. So I never say forever. I don't, for me as well, I just say I'm choosing not to drink at the moment. moderation for me personally was not possible because it actually was harder than drinking, because the thinking that went into moderating took up all my energy. Once I decided to stop, the peace that came with that was huge. So I welcome people to try moderation, and we have tools and tactics to help with that. And then they can decide if they want to go forward with that or if that's not really an option for them. And, you know, with this spectrum, I've had friends who don't drink much at all, but after listening to our podcast and things like that have contacted me and said, you know, I've been inspired. I actually don't want to drink anymore. Now, I would have called them a non-drinker almost anyway. So I think the world is, I think we will find more people that we come across will be non-drinkers who didn't have an alcohol use disorder. So it's a very interesting, very small shift at the moment, but I think we will see that grow, people wanting to look after their health and wellness. But yeah, as far as my coaching, anyone that wants to is sober curious, you know, wants to give it a go for no matter how long, that's what we're there to support them with. And our podcast will discuss all different, you know, options. We talk about things all the time like that. Yeah, so really up to the individual who comes to us, where they are, we will meet them where they are. Bella, what about you?
Oh, I'd have to agree with everything you've said there, Meg. And you don't have to hit rock bottom. You don't have, you know, there aren't many that would fall in the category that I fell in. I was extreme, but I wasn't extreme before then. You know, I was actually quite moderate before then. And I shouldn't have had to have kept on going until I hit that moment. So rock bottom looks very different for many people. It can be waking up and missing a sporting game that your kids have because you're hungover, or it could be getting a DUI. It can be just as hard to stop drinking that two glasses on a Friday and Saturday night emotionally as it can be to stop drinking when you're having a bottle a night, because there is such a reward for you and an emotional connection with it, particularly where mums say, and dads, it's my reward. Oh, that's a really hard belief to undo and untangle, because it's hard to replace that. So it's a lot of work there. But I think support for people can really make the difference between feeling deprived and white-knuckling it, and shifting that view so that you're not fixated on alcohol and that glass, that bottle that's in the fridge, to feeling quite liberated and being able to take or leave it. It's such a nice place to be. So I think if there's anybody that's in that spot where it just feels like, gosh, I just want to give this a shot for more than 30 days free, and I want to be able to do it in a way that I don't feel deprived and I'm not, you know, I don't desire it, go for it. Find out, do some research. There are good books. There are good podcasts. There are good courses. There are coaches like us. So I can only say it's worth it.
So good. And yeah, it is hard to shift because it's a really ingrained cultural belief. It's something that we've really deeply internalized from a lot of external messaging over our entire lives to this point, particularly in an Australian context, I think.
Yeah.
One thing that I want to ask is, I think a lot of people are cautious about saying that they want to pull back from drinking because they think that their friendships are going to suffer or they're going to lose people, and therefore feel isolated, even though they are feeling isolated to an extent because of the alcohol as well. How do you attack that kind of internal wrestle?
Oh, I'd say go quietly if you need to. You don't have to announce that you're not drinking until you feel really comfortable with it. Practice some really good one-liners. I'm driving, or I'm taking a break, or I'm on medication. Find the thing that works for you and just get comfortable in the spot of not drinking, because the benefits that you'll feel will then propel you forward. I also think take a look around in those moments when you're out, so that you kind of get curious and mindful about the socializing when you're alcohol free, because you're going to see that things are better, that those that are drinking hard are not getting having a quality time, and that you're actually engaging really beautifully and deeply with people that are moderate or drinking lightly or not at all. So friendships might shift, but the quality ones stay and grow, and you develop stronger friendships. Like, I would say I was highly anxious about the whole social scene. It really was a large part of my, I ruminated on it, in fact, and it in fact turned out that no one really cared. The vast majority of people didn't even notice, and I now have the best friends. And when people ask me if I want to drink, I say, look, I just don't have time for it. I'm not into it. Or I've taken a break and that's lasted for 3 years, and I make a joke of it. And before I hand over to Meg, I would just say it's contagious. This lifestyle of not drinking, when people see that you can do it and it's fun, you look good and you're happy and energetic, you suddenly find that people want to get on the bandwagon.
Yeah, that's right. And also, I just wanted to add, if you decide like me to go longer term not drinking, the friendship shifts I've had, I have a lot more brunches, walks, theatre, all sorts of things with my friends. The only friendships I have lost were my big drinking ones, which, looking back and during the work I've done, were very surface level. They weren't really authentic anyway. So even though it was a very scary prospect, and it is always, nearly always, I think, for people to go, what about, will I lose friends? I've gained more than I've lost. And whatever friendships you have that are worth keeping will be kept, and maybe you'll do some different things with them, but it'll open up a lot of doors and for some great new, activities and fun in your life.
Yeah, I think that's very inspiring, and from my own experience, I'd say a lot of that rings true. Where can we find you both? How can we get in touch with you?
Well, for me, Meg, I am at Glass Fulfilled, glassfulfilled.com.au, and that's my website. I offer discovery calls for free if people want to contact me. And also, I'm just about to put a 7-day course out for anyone that's sober curious. You might have not been drinking for a while, or you might be deciding if you want to go for a period of time. So it's just a 7-day course. We'll look at the reasons and the, like, worried about losing friendships, all those kind of fears. So that will be on offer very soon. Bella.
She's Sober Sydney.
Yes.
You can follow us on Instagram at She's Sober Sydney, and we can be found on all of your usual podcast spots. In respect of kids and alcohol, I'm at kidsandalcohol.com or .com.au. I think I've got both sites, and that's got the course and a bit of information there. And then if you personally need to get some support to drink less, I'm isabellaferguson.com.au, and I've got a few resources there that you can download, and a 30-day course that you can do self-guided and online to slowly drink less.
And I will put the links to all of those things into the show notes for this episode. Thank you both, Anna. so much for being here.
And thank you, Anna.
Everybody who's listening, go jump across to their respective sites, accounts, follow along. And yeah, I wonder if anybody who is listening has just become a little more sober curious than they were before.
Thank you, Anna, so much.
Love this episode of Anna Asks. It would be a great help if you pop across and leave us a 5-star rating or review. This helps other parents and people to find us and join in the conversation. You can also become a sponsor of this pod for $2.99 Australian a month via the link in the show notes, or head to my website www.annacusack.com.au to grab my free postpartum preparation e-guide. Check out my services or grab my book, Mummy, You're Not Broken. And Until next episode, bye from me. Unless, of course, you want to come chat via socials at Anna Cusack Postpartum before then. See you soon.